Well, welcome everybody to the third session of How Shall We Tell the Stories of Our Lives. This session is on listening for answers, which of course seems to be the appropriate follow-up to asking questions. But rather than have you just listen to people's answers, I wanted to play some pieces for you in which we actually took their answers and turned them into documentaries or, the question of what is a radio documentary can mean anything from about 3 minutes to an hour. I have a 3 minute, a 10 minute, an 18 minute, and a 54 minute documentary. And you don't have to listen to all of them tonight, but I'm going to play excerpts from each of those for you tonight. Oh, welcome back.
Thank you.
So I want to play just a tiny little audio postcard for you at the beginning, which I will say the question about this was, why did the UN just declare falconry an intangible cultural heritage? And so I sent a reporter to the middle of nowhere in Wyoming to find out. And rather than interview somebody from the UN, I said, no, just actually show me what falconry is and why it might be something worth preserving.
Falconry, the sport of training falcons to hunt game. Considered such an important part of human history that it's now included on the UN's list of intangible cultural heritage. The ancient sport is still practiced today. Wyoming Public Radio's Molly Messick spent a day with two longtime falconers and sent us this audio.
Rick Sharp and Tom Meckley are standing in a wide open spot of state land. They're preparing for a hunt with the largest falcon of all, the Jer Falcon. Meckley is tuning in the radio transmitter and receiver system that helps him keep track of his bird. Today, the transmitter is attached to the leg of a gray male called Rex.
So he's worried about.
Meckley has already let out his dog to start looking for game. In this area, that means Hungarian partridge or sage-grouse. Before long, the dog scents a bird, and we stay as still as possible while Meckley lets his falcon fly free.
Once that bird gets in the air, the game realizes that there is a threat there.
Sharp watches as the falcon climbs up and up. All at once, the grouse flies, and Meckley shouts to his bird.
The bird dove, right? Oh, it just hit the grouse. Okay, the bird's back up again.
This flight is what falconers work for. The falcon plunges from high above, targeting its prey.
And by the look of it, the grouse got grounded.
We're shielding our eyes and squinting out to see the falcon and the grouse silhouetted against the sky. The falcon chased the sage grouse into a small, rocky canyon.
Oh, he was very slow.
It's a half an hour later, and the 2-pound falcon is perched on top of the dead grouse 3 times his size.
He's not worried about eating anymore, and he's not so worried about coming home with me, so this is a little dicey right now.
Meckley is stretched out on his stomach in the dirt, trying to lure back his bird. Instead, the falcon flaps its wings and flies off.
He's eating a lot of food.
This scene is breathtaking, and a little funny is stressed about recovering his bird. Now it's perched on a rock 50 feet away.
Looks sort of proud.
Always very proud.
We do get the falcon back, but it takes a little while. After all, it's a nearly wild bird. Falconry isn't always practiced exactly this way, but for 4,000 years, these basic elements have held true. Part of its appeal lies in witnessing something primal, the response of the prey to the falcon and the falcon to the prey. For NPR News, I'm Molly Messick.
Jason, why is that called a postcard?
I generally refer to things as postcards if the sound leads the story. In the same way that, a postcard, you're sending a postcard not so much for what you write, but for to show somebody the picture of the place that you were. And so we talk about audio postcards as it's designed entirely to take you there and put you in the moment, and so you're with them. And it maybe doesn't answer all of your questions about falconry, but it gives you a postcard, sort of a snapshot of the experience of hunting with a falcon, or with other things as well. I've done ones on coyotes, and there's a guy who runs a coyote listening tour in Yellowstone, where you go out and you listen for the coyotes, and so we did that. Generally, I do them where I think the sound is going to lead the story, rather than the story leading the story. So I wanted to play that short little piece to give you an example of how when we go about listening for answers, especially in radio, we're not just listening for what people say, but we're listening for the sounds that take you there. And a long time ago, like maybe 20 years ago or so, NPR had a slogan, an advertising slogan, that was NPR takes you there. And I think it's something that we do much better than a lot of other radio, certainly, and I think much better than you know, print ever could. I've never worked in print, in part because I would not be able to do things like that, to actually put you in the middle of a field in central Wyoming and go falcon hunting. Or at least for me, I'm not good at sort of conjuring that in my own mind from reading it, but I'm good at conjuring it in my mind's eye from listening to it. Any questions or comments about that one?
Jason, have any studies been done by NPR about incorporating sounds into what you do for these postcards? Mm-hmm. Is there a higher response to that from your listeners?
When you ask about, when we've done audience research about what people like about public radio, they tend to like the stories that bring them to a place or take them to a place that they wouldn't normally go to. So I really like to work for those sorts of pieces. You know, it's not easier to do stories out of the White House or out of the Supreme Court or out of Congress, and people do listen to us for those too. It's just not, it doesn't take you anywhere.
Right.
They're important stories to do, but they're not necessarily, they're interesting because they're important. This story is so unimportant it doesn't matter in the world. But I love taking stories that aren't important but making them interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of what I prefer to spend my days doing. Like, none of us likes editing coverage of, you know, a school shooting in Aurora or in Newtown, Connecticut. We really like doing this kind of work. But if we didn't do Congress and the school shootings, no one would take us seriously, and we would just be curating a museum, not something that was vitally important to people. Any other questions or comments? The next piece I'm going to play is a little longer, and it's the only other piece tonight I'm going to play in its entirety. The other pieces that I'm going to play, I'm going to do the beginning of, maybe the first 5 minutes or so of, only because they're much, much longer. But, this is a documentary that aired, actually, it aired a year ago on Labor Day, I believe.
Now to a familiar affliction suffered by veterans and an unusual treatment. We hear a lot these days about post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. It can lead veterans to substance abuse, violence, even suicide. While doctors and researchers try to develop new treatments, one group of veterans in Salt Lake City is finding relief in an old tradition. Our story comes from Taki Telenidis of the Western Folklife Center.
If you didn't know to peer over the 6-foot brick wall next to a parking lot at the Salt Lake VA Center, you'd never guess it was there, a Native American sweat lodge.
I'm getting on. Everyone's there.
It's Friday afternoon, and like he does every week, Cal Bench, a Vietnam vet, is here early, gathering firewood for the ceremony that'll start in a few hours.
Well, I went into the service at 18, I went to Vietnam at 19, and I have no idea how it would change it or affect it mentally. The concept that I would carry that around forever was just hard. But I just never had any place to turn. I came here and I was given a blessing.
Cal started coming to these sweats in 2005 to cope with anxieties related to his combat experience. He found relief in the sweat, as well as a spiritual connection that's kept him coming back. This VA is one of just a handful in the country that offers them. A sweat is a ceremony conducted by a Native American spiritual leader in a dome-shaped structure or lodge. Sweats are common in Indian country.
It's healing
right down to the core of that veteran.
Arnold Thomas is a medicine man from the Shoshone Paiute tribe and has training in social work and chaplaincy. He's conducted the veteran sweats at the VA since 2004.
When they've been overseas in combat, there's a part of them that is left there. So when we have the ceremonies, there's certain prayer songs that I offer and make that effort to bring their spirit back home.
Over the years, these ceremonies, originally intended for Native American vets, have drawn more and more non-natives, men and women from several wars, Vietnam, the Gulf War, Afghanistan, and Iraq. And while the sweats aren't a good fit for every vet who tries them, there's a core group who've added these ceremonies to their medical and psychological treatments. The VA has taken note of their benefits, and in February moved the sweats from the substance abuse program to chaplain services, so they'd be more widely available to vets with PTSD.
Looking at the astounding rate of suicide within the military over the last few years, what I'm reminded is all people had the ability to reason unless they're grieving. So oftentimes I ask the veterans, if you can't reason, what is it you're grieving? And we sit down and I allow that space for them to talk about those feelings, those memories. And so I'll turn that thought, that emotion, intertwine it into a prayer so you can let it go.
As one man brushes clean the 53 stones that have been selected for tonight's sweat, Steve Rich prepares the fire pit which sits next to the lodge. He's a Gulf War veteran with PTSD, and he's going through the VA substance abuse program.
But since Iraq in 1991, I've carried around a couple of, I guess you say, spirits of. One was a friend who was lost over there, and the other was an enemy soldier that I killed.
For 20 years, those memories haunted Steve to the point that he started to abuse alcohol. Then a few months ago, his substance abuse counselor at the VA suggested attending a sweat and bringing those spirits in with him.
So I did, and beginning of the sweat, Arnold the Shaman sings a song that is to call the spirits to the lodge. And so throughout the ceremony that night, I just, you know, imagine them sitting there with me and speaking with me, and got a lot of closure, I guess you'd say, with that. So at the end of the ceremony, we'll do a song that's sending the spirits back to their homes, the spirit world. So when we did that song, I let go of them and released them. To say best, I've been walking around with this backpack with this weight in it, you know, and doing that, I was able to take off the backpack and just set it down and continue on my path, you know.
The fire's been crackling for about 2 hours now, and the stones are beginning to glow red. The sun is low on the horizon, and veterans from the Vietnam War to Afghanistan begin to arrive and mingle around the fire. Most are familiar faces, but tonight, Arnold welcomes a newcomer.
How long have you been in the program?
Days, 14 days.
Okay. Are you going to put?
Yes, sir.
Jared Hooker served in Iraq, and though he's been back for several years, he struggled to come to terms with one particular memory, trying to save a friend whose tank was hit right in front of him.
As we was pulling him out, his helmet fell off of him, and a big chunk of his skull fell off into the floor. Blood everywhere, it was chaos, you know, it was just, I mean, we killed a lot of people in Iraq, but I was never really exposed to that close to someone that I knew.
This happened at the end of Jared's tour, and within a month, he was back home in the States with his family.
And I felt like I said normal, but just having conversations with people instantly were like, dude, we love you and we miss you, man, but you're different. What do you mean I'm different? How am I different? You know, but I was in that mindset. I was still hyper-vigilant, driving.
Jared says he'd swerve his truck whenever he saw trash on the street for fear it concealed a bomb. He was uncomfortable in public places like restaurants. He started drinking and getting in fights.
I remember growing up, I hadn't been in a fight all through my high school career. And when I came back from Iraq, I was ready to throw down with anybody for any reason.
And the drinking got worse.
I hated my life. I drank every night so I'd go to sleep and pass out.
Then came trouble with the police and several arrests, including one that landed him in jail for 3.5 months.
And it really gave me enough time in jail to realize that if I don't stop doing what I'm doing, eventually someone's going to kill me, or I'm going to kill myself.
So in all of this narrative, your story of what you've been through, coming back, how important is tonight to you?
It is very important to me. I'm willing to try anything, so I'm hopeful that this will at least let me get in touch with who I really am and not this monster I've become of being violent and wreaking havoc on other people because I'm hurting.
There's a feeling of anticipation in the air as Medicine Man Arnold Thomas gathers the rattles and drum he'll use for the ceremony.
So I'll pass this rattle around and I'll take it, take some out, pass it on, and it'll be about 15, 20 minutes to now.
The veterans quietly go off to change. The men put on swim shorts, and the women wrap themselves in sheets that they wear like a toga. The medicine man enters the lodge, and the veterans line up in front of the small opening.
Commissioner? All my relations.
Two helpers are busy bringing the glowing stones into the lodge from the fire pit, scooping them out with a pitchfork, brushing off the embers, and carefully walking them into the center of the lodge. Arnold leads the group in a prayer song that gives thanks to the trees for giving us oxygen to breathe, fruit for sustenance, and wood for shelter. The intensity of the song builds with each repetition until he stops singing, then asks the assistants to seal the entrance with heavy fabric.
Okay, they're about to close it up, so I'm going to turn off.
Inside the lodge, it's pitch black, and the group of about 20 sits in a tightly packed circle as the medicine man pours water onto the stones to create steam. For the next several hours, he leads the group in a series of songs and prayers. Three times during the ceremony, the entrance is uncovered to let in the cool night air. A faint light from the nearby parking lot slants through the billowing steam, lighting the group in silhouette for those few minutes. During one of these breaks, the medicine man pulls out a clutch of eagle feathers, then asks the new veteran to stand and walk over to him. He says a blessing, then with the feathers, makes scraping motions over Jared's entire body from head to toe, cleansing him of war. For NPR News, I'm Taki Kalamidas in Salt Lake City.
Was a piece that Taki had pitched to me, and we worked on for about 6 months before it aired. It all takes place in one afternoon, but he had interviewed those men over, the first guy who'd been going since 2005. He'd interviewed him over the course of several months, and then the guy who'd been going for a few months, I think he'd interviewed him over the course of a couple of weeks for this piece, and then he just happened to, the night he was doing the primary recording, he met a first-time guy who was, I thought, incredibly articulate. But he also, I have learned over the past 5 years, I know exactly what PTSD sounds like now. I feel like I could diagnose it. I have heard so much tape of people with PTSD. And I've actually created this little reel in my computer of, like, these are different people with PTSD talking, and they sound incredibly similar. It would be interesting. I would love to talk to a psychologist about verbal patterns and PTSD, because it's so clear to me what it is. Any thoughts, reactions to that piece?
It's very moving. Like you're right there with that person. It also, I was thinking about one of the synod gatherings. There's a pastor in town who does what is called Honorable Welcome Home and does some work with veterans from past and not so far past. And it's very emotional work, but one of the things they talk about is post-traumatic stress syndrome, and then another language that is starting to evolve, which is moral tear.
Hmm.
That these people experience something that tears some of their moral character. And when I hear some of those folks talking, I could hear that and how something like a sweat lodge ceremony kind of could address that because of the spiritual aspect of it. So I thought, interesting how... Anyways, those two conversations merged in my head, but...
When Taki first pitched this to me, he knows of my own interest in religion reporting, and he said, you know, they moved this recently from the substance abuse program to the chaplaincy program. And this has led me to actually be interested in doing some more reporting and bringing in some more pieces about what chaplain, because it's certainly not just chaplaincy work, but in addition to the psychotherapy and substance abuse, but also adding chaplaincy to it. And I would love to look at the ways in which various chaplaincy programs address PTSD.
Yeah, so that's one of the new angle that there. That is a new language that's.
You said moral tear. I haven't heard that before. But
yeah, that people can return from war situations of trauma like that. With, yes, post-traumatic stress syndrome can be diagnosed, but also this language of it tore some moral character within you that you're trying to live with now. That you know, it went against part of your moral character.
Right.
So yeah. Anyway.
I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to play this is that I wasn't sure what the question we were trying to get answered was when Taki said, I want to spend a couple of months hanging out with these guys. But I feel like in hearing it, I know what the questions that... I feel like it supplies answers even though I didn't... And he didn't have questions. And that was one of the... That's what's surprising to me is that, you know, he did not go in with a, here are the points I want to make. He went in on basically a fishing expedition, which... I quite often don't say yes to fishing expeditions because then I end up with 75 hours of tape, which is way too much tape to deal with when the goal is to turn it into 10. This was 10 minutes on All Things Considered. That's, and luckily Taki's very talented and has been doing this work for a very long time, so he knows how to control that. But this was one of those, I don't know that we asked any good questions, but I know that we got a lot of really good answers. There's one image that has stuck with me through this whole, every time I've heard this and when I was originally editing it. And it's just a description, it's not even a natural sound. It's the description of, I think it's the middle guy that you meet, talking about wrapping his affliction in a prayer and letting it go. And I just love that. I love that image. Very similar to the image that the piece ends on. Taki has since followed up with, and we will probably, for Veterans Day, do a follow-up piece with the guy who had just started a year ago. We'll see where he is a year later. He is, in fact, he has kept it up for the past year, and we met him on the first night, so I want to kind of meet him a year later.
With cases like, I mean, post-traumatic stress syndrome, any time you're trying to interview somebody about a traumatic situation, how do you navigate not re-traumatizing them through like asking them questions?
That's a good question. They don't have to talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that with certain... I did a ton of reporting on clergy sex abuse. Just like it was what I did between 2002 and 2007. It was seemed to be the only thing I did. And because I moved, I became religion reporter at Chicago Public Radio in 2002, just as it was all blowing up. And I always tried to be sensitive. You know, they don't have to talk to me, and that's, so that's the first thing. I would say, would you like to talk to me? If you agree to talk to me, I always set up certain sorts of rules, depending on who the person is. Like, you know, if they're an elected official, there are no rules. But if they're an elected official, there are no rules as long as I'm asking them about things that they speak publicly about. But with private citizens, you know, they don't have to talk to me. And I wouldn't say I have a right to know. But I try to talk to them about how important it is for others to hear their stories. And so I would always, you know, thank them for agreeing to speak with me, you know, acknowledge that what they were saying, acknowledge that the story they were going to tell me was difficult, and always say, you know, you can. I will ask questions that may be very personal, and you always have the right to say that's just too personal. I don't want to go into it. I would say that in a decade of covering religion, I don't think, but maybe once or twice did somebody say that's too personal. Mm-hmm. These were also quite often people who had already testified in open court about their abuse. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it wasn't the first time. Something very strange, though, happened when I was covering religion in that people would call me at the radio, because they heard me reporting it, they would call me at the radio station and say, I was abused by a priest and I've never told anybody. And I would say, you shouldn't be talking to a reporter first. Here is the name of, and now, because I'm the kind of person that I am, I would say, here is the name of the prosecutor in this county handling the situation. And I would give them, and then I would call the prosecutor and say, here, I'm putting you two in touch. Which made me a little uncomfortable being that intermediary because I'm not in law enforcement. But I also thought, I should not be the first person you tell this story to. And then after a while, I started adding to that list of people, the people from the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, SNAP. And eventually, when the Archdiocese finally appointed a victim's advocate, although I always advise they not call the victim's advocate first, because their first loyalty was to the Archdiocese and keep them out of court. So the first number I gave them was the prosecutor, because I was the most interested in the truth and not what the church was doing.
Jason, would you expand a little bit on why you don't think the journalist should be the first one to hear that story?
Because I don't think the stories that I was being told were particularly unique. And people had heard on our air many times before similar stories of abuse. I think they were important to be told, but I'm not a prosecutor, I'm not a therapist, and I think that these things were way too sensitive to be worked out in public. And I really tried, I was surprised at the number of people who called, and I was surprised that they were willing to talk to me, and I felt that that had something to do with the oprification of our culture, in that everybody thinks that, like, confessing things publicly is in some way therapeutic, and I don't think so. But I come from a people of steely resolve who don't talk about their problems. So maybe that was my my own little personal problem with people confessing to me too much. I felt like we had already done a ton of the kinds of stories they were going to tell me. And occasionally, in one instance that I recall in particular, I interviewed this guy mostly because he had already been through all of the legal stuff and therapy, but he wanted to speak to a journalist about this guy who had recently come back into the public eye. And I'm concerned when people go to journalists to seek some kind of therapy, because we're not therapists. And at the end of the day, I'm using people. And I mean, I think back to Richard Avedon. I'm using the characters and stories to tell. I'm using these real people's experiences to tell a story, and I don't want to re-victimize them by using them in ways that they're not prepared to deal with. Because you know, the guy's going to tell me that he was abused repeatedly between the ages of 7 and 12, and then I'm going to broadcast that. And in a couple of instances, one in particular, some people from I don't want to say from the diocese, because they weren't from the archdiocese. They were just some people who thought that the people were making things up, and they found his address and harassed him for months afterwards. So I tried to be protective, probably more so than some journalists would want to be protective of sources for stories. Does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes.
Do you have a fair number of people that you interview say periodically, this is off the record?
Yeah, I have a rule about this that some journalists probably disagree with. I always tell them, once I've started recording, it's on the record, and don't tell me anything you don't want to hear broadcast to tens of millions of people. But I don't do, So I do a certain kind of reporting. I like our national security reporters, we have a team of about half a dozen people who cover the NSA and the Pentagon and CIA, who by the nature of their work need to be able to know things off the record that inform the background of their reporting, but don't make it onto the air. And I was always willing to talk to people on background, but they couldn't take things on and off the record while I was recording. I would just mostly say to them, don't tell me anything you're not comfortable hearing. And if I ask you a question that's too personal, just say that's too personal and I won't use it. I never do that with like official people. Like I wouldn't do that with the Cardinal in Chicago. He only once in 10 years sat down for an interview with me. I think if people are going to sit down to talk to journalists, they can't decide back and forth in the middle of an interview what's on and off the record. I generally would say to people who were, you know, real people in the stories, if you feel that you've said, like, because sometimes people get very caught up in the moment of the interview and they maybe go too far, as long as they say right then, oh, you know, I really shouldn't have said that. I don't want you to use that. Depending on how I, you know, the genuineness of how I judge the genuineness of that response, then I would probably be willing to do it, but not certainly not with an official voice, and only rarely with real people. But it was always a judgment call. You know, people think that we have ethics rules in journalism. We have ethics guidelines and ethics precepts that we sort of talk around and talk about and talk with the subjects of the stories and talk with our editors about. And now that I'm an editor, I'm talking with dozens of reporters about all of those decisions that they're making all the time as to what to allow, what to not allow. But I'm not a fan of going on and off the record in the middle of an interview. Did somebody have any other comments or questions about that piece?
So what was your response to that piece?
Which piece, this one?
The one that we just listened to.
We had a lot of response from veterans who wanted, this is always a little strange to me, when people somehow find us to ask, does my local VA offer anything like this? Because I would think, aren't you already attached in some way to your local VA? And so I think we put up on the website some resources for, you know, certainly not a list of every place, but like, here is the website that you can go to look for places. Also, you know, I'm always surprised, and as I said last night about open commenting on websites, I'm always surprised at the incredibly mean and hurtful things that open commenting allows people to say. Like, oh, clearly he's been faking it since Vietnam to get some type of veterans disability benefit. The part of this that is not apparent to the listener is that, I had Taki like go through and like, I asked if each veteran to show us their VA records. I wanted to make sure that each of them had a technical diagnosis of PTSD and that we weren't just throwing that term around, which gets thrown around a lot. So we did all of the background work and background checking and, you know, confirmed that like he was actually in Vietnam, looked at his discharge papers. And those are the things that I know people think we're mistrustful journalists, but in fact, we're just trying to make sure that what we say is true. But you know, because we don't say like, and we look through his papers, which I don't think we have to say because we said he's a veteran, that he was in Vietnam, I think that's enough. We still get, you know, listeners who, not many, but you know, a few who say he's faking it or he's probably not even really in Vietnam. That sort of response. I'm always surprised at how completely heartless some people on our website are. I don't believe that those actually are our listeners. At least I imagine that they're not our listeners. I imagine that they are the trolls who live in the internet.
Do you respond to those? Do you respond to responses?
It's our rule to not respond to online commenting that is sort of a general nature, because underneath any story, people can write comments. There are a few instances when we will actually take down what they say if we have sort of hate speech guidelines that we'll take down. I'm on the committee that is trying to fix this right now and actually not allow open commenting on our website, but it's a long haul because there are some people who believe comments are content, and I think that they are not. They're crazy people. Now, that is very different from, say, people who write letters to us. Like, if you go to the website, there's a whole section where, like, I want to write a letter to All Things Considered, which we read on the air usually 3 or 4 times a week. Those tend to be much more thoughtful comments because they've taken the time to not just, you know, and we fact check them. So if a person writes in, we call them, confirm that they are who they say they are, and, you know, say, well, you've written this, like, 3-page letter. We would like to use this one 30-second excerpt because we don't read 3-page letters on the air. Those, I think, are much more valuable. I think that the hurdle of getting, of actually like sitting down and typing something that you had to go find the way to get it to the right people is different than online commenting.
Well, I also, when I look at online commenting, I also notice sometimes the facts that they are quoting and the facts that they use in the comments are I don't know where they get them.
Yeah, this is actually an issue that I think that sometimes editors, I as an editor, if somebody basically says this is wrong in a story that I know to be true, and I know that it's actually not wrong, I would love to respond. The problem is you then engage in this
fight with crazy talk.
If you engage the crazy talk, it only sort of foments more crazy talk. And I'm editing hundreds and hundreds of pieces a year. I don't have time to fight with people about their, you know, what they think to be true. They don't actually, a lot of people just simply don't understand the level of fact-checking and truth-squatting that we do on pieces. If a reporter says it, they have made sure, like hosts and reporters want nothing more than to make sure that everything they say is actually right on the air. We don't play fast and loose with the facts. Even, you know, when people, I even have a problem with if somebody is quoted in a piece and says something that's wrong. I threw a minor hissy fit on the day that Prop 8 was being argued in the Supreme Court, because on Morning Edition, in a piece of tape, so it wasn't a reporter saying it, it was a quote from a person, said on the air, she was the wife of a pastor of a megachurch in Texas. And she said, well, every time that same-sex marriage has become legal in the United States, it's always been a court imposing it on the people. And this was in March of this year, after which the legislatures in Connecticut and New York had actually legalized it through legislation, and after which Washington, Maryland, Minnesota, and Maine had passed it through votes. And so her quote was factually inaccurate. And as an editor, I would not have allowed that quote on the air, and I think that I don't think you should allow it anyway, but some editors would say, well, you could let the person say it, but then immediately afterwards you would actually correct them. The problem is there have been lots and lots of studies, and On the Media has reported on this extensively, that once a thing is said, it becomes true on the air. And so listeners hear things that even if you immediately correct them, they've heard it as this thing I heard on NPR. And so I would have not allowed that piece of tape to get on the air.
There's that one commercial where the girl says, well, I read it on the internet.
Right.
And I think that's also, you know, I've read it on the internet, really a person's defense.
Right. And I mean, and I would like to think that, like, whatever we do allow on NPR should be true. And so I would not have allowed it, and I actually think we should have done a correction. And I kind of lost that battle in part because our managing editor for standards and practices was on vacation. But I told him about it later, and he said, I think we should do on the web build-out for it. We did write a asterisk, you know, this is actually untrue, here's what's real. But we didn't do it on air because it would have been so much later. You know, days or weeks afterwards. And it wasn't a factual error that we made. It was a factual error that we allowed to happen on the air. So that was the reason we didn't do it on air. Oh my God, it's already almost 27. Let me play the beginning of one more piece for you. This is an hour-long documentary by Kelly McEvers, our Beirut correspondent, and she has been going in and out of Syria for the last couple of years. And she was our Baghdad correspondent for that because she likes going to paradises. I don't quite know how I want to do that. What I would love to do is like find a time either tonight or tomorrow when I could just like turn this on and let people who want to listen to the whole thing listen. But I don't want to try to do that now because we've got 4 minutes and this is an hour long documentary. Let me just play the very beginning of it.
From the public radio website transom.org and presented by PRX in collaboration with NPR, this is Diary of a Bad Year, a War Correspondent's Dilemma. It's independently produced by NPR's Middle East correspondent, Kelly McEvers, and me, Jay Allison. 2012 was one of the deadliest years on record for journalists. The Arab uprisings, and now the conflict in Syria, have claimed the lives of dozens of reporters. And yet, they still go back into conflict.
Yeah, right, so this is one of those moments where you're like speeding down the road in a car with dudes with guns. You have no idea where you're going. And part of you thinks it's a really good idea. Way outside of any town or village, just over the border, with three guys who have AK-47s. They are all, you know, wearing green khaki type jackets and, you know, headscarves tied around their hair. They got beards. They're psyched. You know, they're clearly like pumped with adrenaline. Can't stop thinking like, why am I doing this? I know the answers and none of them are good. I'm doing this because other people did it and I felt competitive. I'm doing this because I've been trying to get some kind of access for like 2 weeks and now that I finally got it, I did it. I'm also worried that if I make it out, that's like one more step toward the abyss. Every time you make it out okay, it's like further down the road you go, thinking that you're always gonna make it out okay. It's been a bad year. Actually, it's been a bad couple of years. It all started back in 2011. Not in that bombed out car with the gun dudes, but earlier. It was the year of the Arab Spring. Protesters were flooding the streets across the Arab world. Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, Bahrain, Libya, Syria. Millions and millions of people calling for the downfall of dictators. I was stuck in Baghdad, watching it all on TV. I was the NPR correspondent there. I kept writing to my boss, put me in, coach. Then something terrible happened. Word came that two reporters were with rebel fighters in Libya when they took mortar fire. Cameraman Tim Hetherington died almost immediately. Photographer Chris Hondros survived a major head injury, but the situation did not look good. I frantically read Facebook and Twitter posts from the field hospital where Chris had been taken. A friend was handed his blood-filled helmet before he died. I had known Chris, sort of. He was a lovely guy who I'd seen speak a few times, gone drinking with a few times. He was one of those guys who's almost universally loved by the tribe. That's what we call ourselves, foreign correspondents who work in dicey places, the tribe. Losing Chris and Tim was very bad for the tribe. For days, I read posts about the horrible task of bringing their bodies out of Libya. I watched Tim's experimental film about what it's like to be a reporter in a war zone and what it's like to try to come home. In one scene, he's sitting in the backseat of a car as it whizzes down some muddy road in Africa. The car is full of guys with guns. That is the best feeling, I said to myself, when you're on your way into the complete unknown. And then I started to cry. Sitting at my desk the next day, things began moving in slow motion. I would pass my hand in front of my face, and it felt like it was weighted. I couldn't hear right, couldn't finish a sentence. I started torturing myself with questions. What the hell were they thinking? What the hell was I thinking? Why do we do this job when we know what's at stake? When we know we could die? I realized I needed help, so I called a psychiatrist who NPR kept on retainer at the time. His name is Mark Brain. He used to be a foreign correspondent too. Now he specializes in trauma. Mark did what a good shrink is supposed to do. He helped me understand I was not some kind of freak. I recorded his side of the conversation.
It's just, it's the straw on the camel. You know, you don't know that the poor old camel is about to break its back. You just add that one extra straw and bang. It's not the straw that did it, it's the accumulation. And it's very normal, Kelly. It's just incredibly normal. Are you with me? It's like your brain has slowed down after the news of the deaths in Libya, so saying, I'm processing a whole load of stuff here, Kelly. I just haven't got the wherewithal at the moment to help you concentrate on something else. What do you enjoy doing, Kelly? What fills your batteries?
Spending time with my kid, I said. Her name's Loretta. She's a toddler now.
Where's your daughter? Tell me about your daughter. I didn't realize you're a mum.
She stays with her dad, my husband, in Istanbul, I said, while I'm working in Baghdad.
Ouch. Ouch, ouch, ouch. There's no beating about the bush. I mean, there's no getting away from that, Kelly. That's tough. Yeah.
All of a sudden, Mark seemed horrified that I was doing this job, even though I have a little kid. I started to lose it. This is why I'm calling, I told him. I think this whole weird reaction to Chris and Tim's death is more than just some overloaded system thing. I think I'm really starting to question everything I do. I mean, why do I do this job? Why do any of us do this job? Mark tried to explain that we do this job because it's important. It's important to be a witness to history. He also said our bodies are still equipped to survive on the plains of Africa, back in the day when we had to escape large predators. In times of danger, we emit massive quantities of adrenaline. Once you've had a taste, he said, it's hard to give up. Mark tried to comfort me in the fact that even though I might be addicted to adrenaline, I did stay put. I didn't try to go to Libya, where a war was raging.
And I think, Kelly, it's about being conscious, above all. Being aware that, yes, you can make choices. You know, and these are not easy choices. Whichever way you go, you know, whatever happens, they are very, very difficult choices. And they matter enormously.
Mark was basically telling me it's okay to walk away from this job. And that was definitely not something I wanted to hear. I told him he'd been...
It goes on for another 50 minutes, but the reason that I wanted to play this excerpt for you is that the rest of this piece is her trying to come up with an answer for two answers. Why do I do what I do? Or why do I do what I do? Or why do I keep doing what I do? And what if I get killed over there? What'll happen to my husband and daughter? And the hour continues with her asking different people that question. She talks to Sebastian Younger. She talks to other people who she's reported with over the years. And the piece ends, and this will be the little tease, with her writing a letter to her husband and daughter that is... She reads it to us, but they don't hear it, and she says she's not going to let them hear it because it's the letter that they need to open when she's killed while reporting overseas. So I will tease that much out. So if you want to hear the rest of it, we can come up with a time to just play. I'll just turn it on, and you can sit in here and listen to it. Okay. I mean, we've got 10 minutes until Vespers, so happy to answer one or two final questions. Any comments, responses to that?
Is there a general ratio of time? You said that 10-minute piece, how many hours of preparation go into it? If we hear a 4-minute piece, a 10-minute piece?
You know, people always try to come up with rules of thumb around this. That 3-minute piece, she spent a whole day with them. You know, she drove from Laramie, where she lived, into some place a couple of hours away, probably spent 3 or 4 hours out there hunting with them, then came back. So she probably had 3 or 4 hours of tape, but had spent a whole day getting there and back as well.
And then the editing process?
You know, she wrote a first draft. The process that I work with reporters is that once, you know, we talk about what they're going to go and get when they're out there, then they come back and they write a first draft, and then I listen to it. I never read scripts because it has to work as radio, so I listen to a first draft. I give them feedback. Usually I'm very interested in structure, structuring the piece or restructuring the piece. Then they rewrite it again. And then in the second edit, we do sort of a line-by-line edit. I have an iron fist over the words that are said that go out under my imprimatur. So we go over it line-by-line, and we, during that period, fact-check. I have the reference library on the line with me, and they listen in and say, well, like, is this really a gerfalcon? What is the average weight of a gerfalcon? Are we right about that? So it's, you know, heavily fact-checked. And then it's rewritten, and then the third edit is basically what it's going to sound like on the air. And so then I might trim, like, a, you know, 5 or 10 seconds just to make sure that it fits. That piece had to be exactly 3 minutes long. So that was, you know, probably, let's see, a day of recording, another day or day and a half of writing and editing. So 2.5, 3 days for that piece.
Yeah.
So that's the, you know, the diary of a very bad year. She kept an audio diary for a year to produce an hour of radio. Well, I shouldn't say to produce that hour of radio. She also did, you know, dozens and dozens of reports for All Things Considered and Morning Edition out of Syria. So, that was, you know, in her spare time when she was not risking her life, she was working on this documentary. It really varies, though.
Some reporters get into some pretty deep discussions with people which are borderline being eventually leading to further discussions precipitated by law enforcement officials or attorneys. Have you been involved in any of those situations?
Do you mean where prosecutors or attorneys have asked us for raw tape?
Yeah.
This happens all the time, and the answer is always no. I mean, they have to subpoena us before we'll do it, and then we, as soon as that happened, well, first, the answer is always no if it's just a request, and if we're subpoenaed, then we send it to the general counsel's office, and they fight it tooth and nail.
You ever been arrested for?
We have never actually had to turn over information. I know that the when Nina had found Anita Hill, there were threats of subpoenaing her notes, which you know, we fought tooth and nail. We are not part of the prosecution process. That's not why we do what we do. So, you know, what I said earlier, mentioning, you know, giving the names of the prosecutors, I felt like I was not getting involved. I was giving them something that they could have found themselves. I was just sort of easing the process for them. But I know there are other reporters who would never do that either. Okay. So tomorrow night we'll listen to two of my very favorite pieces about why storytelling makes us human that involve a lot of Virginia Woolf and brain chemistry. Thank you.